You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Good evening. Welcome. I'm Bronwyn Maddox, editor of Prospect. Delighted to welcome you to this event tonight, Time Reborn, a new view of time, a new view of the world. Lise Wohlen has produced yet another controversial book. A professor at the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics, an adjunct professor of physics at the University of Waterloo. He's made a speciality of producing these books at periodic intervals, questioning some of the fundamental principles of science and physics as it has been developed so far. And this latest one has already attracted a great deal of controversy. He's going to expand on his ideas, but in summary, he's challenging the idea that time, that the laws of physics are fixed or eternal, and is going to propose a new theory of time. And he's taken, in this very challenging book, he's expanded this theory not just to take on theoretical physics and waded right into the current arguments of that, but said that this really changes our entire notion of human agency, of what we're doing as humans, of how we should regard ourselves as acting in time, with consequences, he argues, for how we should look at economics, morality, society. And with us tonight to discuss that are Professor A.C. Grayling, philosopher, master of the New College of the Humanities in London, and Dr. Gillian Tett, an author and assistant editor of the Financial Times, who are going to challenge him on both those wings. And judging by Lise Wohlen's marvellous willingness to respond, even online, to the many interlocutors that he's acquired, we're looking for a great exchange. With no more introduction, though, I'm going to give over to Lise Wohlen, who's going to open for about 20 minutes, setting out his ideas before everyone wades in. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm honored. I'm deeply honored to be here. I'm terrified and intimidated by the expertise of the panel that's been assembled. And I'm thrilled and puzzled to have been taken so seriously. Maybe I should explain. This book comes out of many years of thinking about the puzzles and the problems that physics and cosmology faces. It presents views that I came to slowly over many years, beginning with actually the discussion of my first book, Life of the Cosmos, which already had the idea of laws of nature evolving. The background for this book is varied, but a very important element of it is a set of conversations I began to have with the philosopher Roberto Mangibera Unger at Harvard Law School, who also, from his point of view as a social and political and legal theorist, had come to the view that we must live in a universe where laws of nature evolve and where time is real to permit human beings to have the kind of agency that we imagine we need if we're going to address the problems that we face. And Roberto and I engaged on a common project, one output of which is this book by myself, but there are other outputs in progress, papers, scientific papers, philosophical papers, and a joint book. Now, I'm going to take as evident, and I'm not a scholar, so I'm just going to assert that social thought is influenced by our cosmological ideas and vice versa, and there are many examples that scholars cite. For example, the interchanges between John Locke and Newton. Roberto Unger and myself and some other people are proposing a large shift in our cosmological ideas, and I'll frame the shift in a few minutes. And what we're here to do today, and again, I set out this prospect in the epilogue of the book, but it's remarkable and it's a wonderful thing, I would say, about British intellectual life to be taken seriously at this. What I set out in the epilogue is the implications, some thoughts as a non-expert. I'm not an economist, I'm not a social theorist, I'm not a politician. I'm not an expert on climate change, but nonetheless, I thought it was important to say that there were implications of this paradigm shift in cosmology for how we conceive of ourselves, for how we conceive of the future, because how we think about time influences how we think about the future, as I'll describe in a minute, and for how we think about the possibilities of solving the problems that face us, from personal issues in our family lives to economics to climate change. Now, what are the key claims in the book? And I'm just going to state them because I just have a short time. And I'm going to state first the claims and then characterize the paradigm shift that we are promoting or that we are suggesting. The claims of the book are that, one, in physics, as opposed to ordinary life, there is a belief that our experience of the daily, of the present moment, our experience of time as a flow of moments is an illusion. Einstein said famously that we who understand physics know that the distinction between past, present, and future is only a remarkably persistent illusion. And this idea that our experience of time is not real, but we live embedded in a timeless universe, the true view of which is a perspective of the whole universe through time as one, is central to physics in the 20th century. It's central to the interpretations of relativity theory, central to how we think about quantum theory, and as my friend Julian Barber set out about 10 years ago in his book, The End of Time, central to how we think about the unifications of physics that those of us who work on them study, so-called quantum theories of cosmology. Now, we oppose this, and we oppose this making a move in two steps. One of them is to argue that this idea that time is unreal, that the future is determined, and so forth, is an overinterpretation of a method, and it's a method that is very well suited to studying small parts of the universe. Where we differ and where we impose a wedge is taking this method and this characterization of nature and extending it from small parts of the universe to the universe as a whole. So that move, if you have a method which is well suited to study individuals, to study small parts of a system, whether it's a cosmology or social system, it's incorrect to just take the same ideas and apply them to the full closed system that they're part of. That's the first move we make. We then claim that in order to have a theory which can successfully answer the problems and the challenges of a theory of the whole universe, it must be one in which embraces the reality of the present moment and the reality of the flow of time. And in particular, that there be no timeless truths, that there be no laws which hold outside of time, but instead that laws of nature, as with every other natural phenomenon, evolve in time. Now, the science part is hypotheses about how they may evolve, testing those hypotheses, developing those hypotheses. That's not what we're talking about tonight, but that is developed in the book. Now, here's one way to characterize the shift that we're advocating, that we're proposing. It's in the context of naturalism. Naturalism is the philosophical point of view or the framework in which we say that all that exists is the natural world which science studies. There's no separate mental realm, there's no separate realm of the soul apart from what's part of the natural world, and there's no other worlds, like there's no mathematical worlds which somehow exist autonomously of the natural world. But there are two versions of naturalism which I think have to be teased out and opposed to each other. So I'm going to call them naturalism 1 and naturalism 2, or timeless naturalism and temporal naturalism. So here's naturalism 1. Naturalism 1, timeless naturalism, holds that the laws of nature are timeless, immutable. They influence what happens. They determine what happens in the universe, but what happens in the universe does not change them. They are immutable, hence inexplicable by any means checkable by experiment. And that's the problem with naturalism 1. The experience of the present moment, the distinction between past, present, and future, every other kind of human experience that we value, sensation, will, agency, imagination, the impression we have that life brings forth surprise, that life brings forth novelty, are all illusions. What's real is what the atomist, the Greek atomist, called just atoms moving in a void. This is an expression of that philosophy. Atoms with timeless, eternal properties, moving according to timeless laws in a space which is timeless. Everything else being an illusion, in the sense that when you get right down to it, when you reduce the phenomena to their essential parts, you just have atoms moving in a void. The future, by the way, is determined. The idea that the future is already determined from the present is part of this naturalism version one, and survives in quantum theory, in versions of quantum theory with the quantum state. I'm saying this in case there are any quantum physicists around. This applies to you too. And then the metaphysical or mystical aspect of this is that if all of that are illusions, what's real? Well, what's real is claimed to be some, quote, mathematical reality which is timeless and which mirrors the world, in the sense that the true nature, the true properties of everything in the real world are mirrored in some mathematical equation, some mathematical formula, such that anything that develops in time already could be accounted for on the basis of a mathematical computation which is carried out outside of time. Okay, so that's naturalism one, timeless naturalism. And that's what Einstein was talking about when he said this, when he made the quote that I quoted. That's what I was brought up in. In fact, that's what I went into physics to realize, is the construction of these timeless laws, the discovery of these timeless laws of nature. In naturalism too, all that is real in a moment. All that is true in a moment, which is one of a succession of moments. So this is temporal naturalism. All that exists is part of nature, but nature exists moment to moment to moment to moment. And everything that is real or true at a moment is such at a moment of time. In other words, our experience of the world is lived through a succession of moments, is not an illusion, is not some peculiarity of our psychology, but is one of the deep insights that we have the privilege of having into the constitution of nature. Laws cannot be timeless, because nothing can be timeless in this domain. Laws, there will be general laws, they will hold for some regions of space and time, but they're not absolute, they're not immutable, they evolve like everything else, maybe sometimes slower, maybe sometimes abruptly. The mechanisms by which laws evolve are what we should be really interested in as naturalists. Just like biologists used to be interested in characterizing the absolute essential properties of species until they realized that there was the story of evolution that connected all the species together, and that was the deep structure that one really had to understand, is how the species evolved. We advocate that cosmology and physics has to make the similar transition. The future is certainly predictable to some extent. Physics works for small regions of space and time, but the argument that physics is deterministic, that nature is deterministic, that the future is already present, is not applicable. So the future may be partly open. Nature has the capacity to bring forth novel states of affairs to which novel laws may govern. And their mathematics, while being a useful tool, is not the mirror of nature. There's no mathematical object which is the perfect mirror of nature. And we would argue that if you take seriously that the present moment is part of the natural world that naturalism is supposed to describe and account for, then there can't be a perfect mathematical mirror of nature, because no mathematical object has the property of existing moment by moment to moment to moment. There are no present moments. There's no flow of moments in any mathematical object. So that's naturalism too. Now, that's the scientific claim of the book, and that's what most of the book develops. Since I thought I hadn't taken on enough risk in writing a book that argues that there are no timeless truths, I thought to give myself the challenge of writing an epilogue where I addressed the transition from Naturalism 1 to Naturalism 2 as a human being, what it meant for me in my personal life, which is off the table here, but which I hint about there, what it means for us as a society, which is very much on the table here. I think I just want to make a broad, ambitious claim and then leave the discussion open. So the claim I would make is that it matters. When we think about, and I'll just focus on climate change because that's such an important issue, and it has all the issues related to time, because the issue about climate change is the uncertainty of the future, is it not? The best science will not tell us how bad it will be if we do nothing. Therefore, we face making good decisions about an uncertain future, which is, of course, the situation of human life. The situation of human life is to be balanced between danger and opportunity. And this is just a particularly acute form of it. So when we are balanced between danger and opportunity and the future is unknown, how do we think usefully about the future? And I think if we imagine ourselves living in a cosmos in which novelty is an illusion, agency is an illusion, will is an illusion, there's a demoralization that takes place. There's an alienation that takes place from between our aspirations and our view of the universe we live in. If we imagine ourselves living in a universe in which everything changes and everything evolves, in which novelty is a real possibility, in which the imagination of human beings is an organ that takes advantage of the natural capacity to invent novel phenomenon and for novel regularities to arise, then we may get a moral lift. We may think to ourselves, maybe, even if we can't see how, it's possible that we have the agency, the imagination, the will to invent our way out of the problems that face us.
Professor Smolin, thank you, and actually uniquely in my experience, the main speaker ahead of time. Thank you. So there you have it. Time is real. Physics is in crisis. The laws of nature aren't fixed, but they evolve. And will is an illusion. Okay, we're going to debate this now among us and with Professor Smolin. And I'm going to start with Anthony Grayling, who might want to come back with on some of
scientific
or philosophical points.
Indeed. Well, I start from a very, very advantageous position of almost complete ignorance of the cosmology and physics of what Lee has been talking about. So that's very useful, especially to a philosopher. It's never a barrier to philosophical disposition, ignorance. Firstly, I have to say that I find Lee's position about the place of the concept of time in discussion of natural law rather attractive. And insofar as I'm in any position to judge, it looks as though he's issued a challenge to his fellow physicists of a very interesting kind. I do want, though, to register just one or two little thoughts, some of which are tangential, perhaps. One is that, with the very honourable exception of Einstein and relativistic physics, and then Einstein, as I understand it, was taking the view that there is no privileged position either in space or time or in the space-time continuum from which one could nominate an event as being past or present or future. And that for that reason argued or claimed that time, as we understand time in the normal sense, is unreal. Almost all other metaphysical positions which have turned on the claim that time is unreal are in fact very unattractive ones. Plato regarded knowledge as having as its object unchanging, perfect, immutable truths which cannot occupy this sublunary realm, the realm of change and imperfection, but must occupy an eternal, that is, outside time realm where they never change and they're perfect. And this view, this Platonic view, has been one which is largely, of course, influenced religious conceptions of the universe. Again, the concept of eternity, of something being outside the natural order, outside space and time, is a very important component of a religious view, and it has come into philosophy in one or two ways. Lee mentioned Newton's view. I'm not at all myself clear that Newton thought that time is unreal. He thought it's absolute, but that his reason for thinking that it's absolute might have been a positivistic one. You can see this when you look at what his friend John Locke had to say about time. Locke noticed that times are very subjectively appreciated. So what might for you pass in a flash because you're enjoying it enormously might pass for somebody else very slowly because they're not enjoying it. And the subjective difference in perceptions of time require of us that we find some public features of the environment, for example, the apparent transfer of the sun across the sky or the radioactive decay of the cesium atom or whatever is more recently, I think there is a more recent way of measuring time, and using that to annex these public times, these subjective times to one another to make public time. And then, said Locke, what we do is we extrapolate ad infinitum, public time, into the future and into the past to get an absolute conception. And so something like that was at work in Newton's thinking about space and time. He made the assumption that they are absolutes and can be used as a frame of reference for what else is happening in the world. He was challenged on this assumption by Leibniz, of course, who brought forward a kind of proto-version of the relativistic view, and one which I think Lee finds quite attractive in some of its applications. And I think, rightly, I think Leibniz was very interesting on that point. But in almost all other cases, the idea that time is an illusion, that it's unreal, that genuine reality is atemporal in some way, is associated with a tradition of metaphysical thinking, which is at odds, in fact, with a lot of other thinking in the history of philosophy, indeed the history of thought in general. For example, it's an assumption of history that there is time. It is an assumption of our psychological interpretations of the self and of our relationships, that there is narrative structure to them, and that involves time. So it may very well be that there is a disconnect, in a way, between how we think about lived reality as being something essentially time-bound, with all the tragedy of aging and the delight of the recurrence of seasons and so on, and the kind of view, the Neoplatonic view or Platonistic view about the unreality of time. So one thing that perhaps one might guard against a little bit is to equivocate on the idea of time and timelessness. Here is a timeless truth I'm just about to tell you, and I'm sure Lee will enjoy this, and you will notice it takes the form of a conditional. If we understand by 1 plus equals in 2 what we currently understand, then 1 plus 1 equals 2. Now that is a timeless truth just by definition. So there is a sense in which you could nominate, in fact, a whole class, in fact, an infinite class of timeless truths in that sense. They're not an interesting sense from the point of view of physics and of natural law, but it's really very important to note that there are uses of expressions like timelessness, and truths can become permanent. I mean, it is now a truth forever that this meeting occurred on this date, at this time, in this place. Nothing is going to change that, however much future generations may wish to rewrite this out of horror at Lee's proposals. Nevertheless, it is now a truth forever. So that there are senses in which one would want to retain some use for notions of timelessness and permanence. But they don't influence, they don't affect really what Lee has to say. And so for that reason, one can, I think, be very attracted by the idea that here is an exciting new proposal which needs to be examined by Lee's professional colleagues and put to the test. I mean, one thing that Lee does say in his book again and again is that good science must issue in predictions, and the predictions must be testable. And there are a number of things suggested by Lee in the book which would issue, I think, in experimental tests. And so the proof of the pudding will indeed lie in those tests, I think. My final two little comments about it are these. I know that you were all reading Mark Twain in the bath last night, and in fact you were reading his wonderful little story, 3,000 Years Among the Microbes. Does anybody know that story? In which he imagines a character called Huck, actually not Huckleberry Finn, but Huxley, but shortened to Huck, because his name is unpronounceable by the people he finds himself among, manages to get into the interior world of a human body, where the mighty streams, the blood vessels, the arteries and so on, are relative to the size of the microbe that he is, vaster than the Mississippi. He talks about the fact that when you get down to the microscopic scale, the whole proportion of the universe that you occupy changes. You suddenly find yourself, if you're a very, very tiny entity, in a world so large that even if it were the interior of the human body, it would be unimaginable that you would have to think of a river that the Mississippi, for example, would have to be as wide as the United States themselves. This kind of conceit occurs in the book, and it's a radical, dramatic, and fascinating way of forcing you to reconfigure your conceptions about scale. And I wonder, because we too often do this as human beings, is that we project from our own experience, our own scale of things, and our understanding of the world from the point of view that we occupy. Now, the point has very well been made that we are the size and shape we are because we inhabit a planet of this size and this mass at these temperatures with these pressures, and that if we were very much smaller or very much larger, the universe might look rather different to us. And I just wonder whether there isn't the danger of projecting some of our categories of thought into the universal, into the very large scale and into the very small scale. Is it possible that our experience of time, the felt reality of the passage of time, is something that we are taking too far in reading into how things might be in the structure of the universe at very different scales? So that's a question. It's not a criticism, but it's just a question, I think, that one needs to address. And finally, there is one thing that we may come back to a little bit later, and that is that Lee is very scrupulous throughout the book in saying he's a naturalist. He's a naturalist of type 2. It's a bit like having a blood type. So I'm a naturalist of type 2, and this is a temporal naturalist, that there must be prediction and there must be testable prediction in this theory. And then you very, very slightly disconcert us towards the end of the book, Lee, by saying that the phenomenon of consciousness is not one that can be inferred from anything that we know about the central nervous system. And so all of a sudden we find ourselves on the blurry margins of naturalism there. And perhaps later on you'll say something about that.
Please do.
Yeah, so you've carefully made notes, which is excellent. But I wonder, before you kindly respond, whether we can go to Gillian.
All right, well, I'm going to go on a slightly different tack. I should start by saying I'm not often introduced as Dr. Gillian Tett, but since I feel thoroughly outflanked by two professors, I think I need all the help I can get. I'm going to make a few comments on what Professor Smolin has written in terms of the world of economics and finance. Because something that has fascinated me in the last two decades of working as a financial journalist, and before that I was actually trained as a cultural anthropologist, but something that's fascinated me is the degree to which modern economics has suffered from what might be called physics envy. And by that I mean, if you go back a couple of centuries and look at how people try to make sense of the world of money, initially, it was viewed really as part of the social sciences, almost an art, if you like. If you look back to Jane Austen, who would talk about home economics, she really looked at it as a kind of management issue, an offshoot of everyday life. But starting in the middle of the last century, economics moved from being something, or the movement of money moved from being something that was a mysterious sort of art form or an offshoot of social sciences into something that was far more quantitative in its nature. And in essence, the idea took hold that economies were rather similar to the hard sciences, and that an equilibrium could be discovered in the way that money worked and the way that economics worked. Now, that's sketched out very well in the epilogue to Professor Smolin's book. And one offshoot of that idea is that economists and financiers have increasingly imported forms of physics and maths to try and make sense of how markets and economies worked, on the presumption that there was this natural, almost timeless set of laws that could be created about how economics should be operating. Now, to me, coming in as an anthropologist into the world of finance and economics really about a decade ago, this always seemed to me to be very, very peculiar indeed. That's partly because I was trained not in the hard sciences, but in anthropology, where essentially there is a very strong relativist streak to almost everything you look at. Anthropology is a discipline which is very context-based, and most anthropologists do not believe in the idea of there being fundamental truths. It was often perceived as one of the great divides between the hard sciences and the social sciences. But the other reason why I found the quantitative approach to economics, or the narrowly quantitative approach to economics, as expressed by things like the efficient market hypothesis, to be rather peculiar, was because on the ground, it often seemed to me that it simply didn't work. I mean, as George Soros, the hedge fund investor, is fond of saying, you know, markets are essentially reflexive. We don't all exist like atoms. We learn from each other, we react to each other, and we economies and markets have a habit of changing over time. But if you go back to the City of London or Wall Street before 2007 and looked at how the debate about economics was very much shaped back then, the fact was that people like me were very much in the minority, and quantitative theories and this presumption of having a stable equilibrium was absolutely dominant. In fact, it was quite embarrassing to tell people that you were a financial journalist with a PhD, not in advanced economics, not in physics or cosmology, but in social sciences, in social anthropology. It was all seen as a bit hippie and irrelevant. But what I find fascinating in terms of the message from Professor Smolin's book is that in some ways I was wrong to be criticizing economics for borrowing so heavily from physics. Because the fact is, the issue wasn't the fact that economists were borrowing from physics or mathematics, it was rather they were borrowing the wrong type of physics and mathematics. They were borrowing this idea of the universe being full of eternal timeless truths that essentially could be uncovered and applied to the way that money worked in a rather crude, rudimentary fashion. And so in many ways, I think his work really does challenge us to think not just about the import of quantitative techniques into the world of money and policy making, but also to reflect on what we can perhaps learn from his vision of physics and this new appreciation for time. If it's true that in fact physics can, or physical laws can evolve and change through the passage of time, and if it's true that essentially physics is path dependent, which I think is perhaps the most important word of all in terms of trying to communicate these ideas to lay people, i.e. human beings can learn from the past and respond and move forward, the natural universe can also learn and change. Each time a law of physics takes place, it changes things and essentially creates some form of, if not evolution, then adaptation or change. If that is the case, then that has a lot of implications for how we devise policy in terms of running an economy. It has implications for how we try and make sense of markets. It has implications for simply assuming that what's happened in the past will be the perfect guide to the future. So I'll just end by saying that one of the most inspirational things that I find in his book is this point that actually we don't all need to live in extreme silos in terms of academic and intellectual thought. We don't need to assume that there is such a deep divide between the social sciences, between relativist, context-bound anthropologists and the hard sciences. We can all learn from each other, and we all need to learn from each other, not just to try and look afresh at the world of physics, but also to look afresh at the world of economics too. And frankly, if there was ever a really timely moment, not to crack a bad joke, to be doing this, it really is today, when the Western world is confronted with so many very, very profound, intractable economic challenges, for which, frankly, the past is not a very good guide for either predicting the future or trying to fashion policy today.
Gillian, Brilliant. Thank you very much. Well, there you have it, an elegant ascent, if I can put it that way, that the hard sciences aren't hard either. Following Anthony's exposition on our notions of time and timelessness, Professor Smullen, do you want to respond to those?
Okay, well, first of all, let me thank Gillian. To me, it's remarkable that the limitations of neoclassical economic theory and the efficient market hypothesis are obvious and are known to economists if you push them on the point. The reason why they like... So let me just address and bring out what you were talking about in your remarks. The reason why the notion of equilibrium is so attractive is it renders irrelevant all the human aspects, all the contingent and historically based and path-dependent aspects that you were interested in. Because if there is a single equilibrium at which market forces balance, and this is then, and everybody is as well off as they could be in that equilibrium, then the most just, the most ethical thing to do is to relax all regulations on the market and let the market go to its true equilibrium, at which point we will all benefit maximally. And these kind of arguments were made in the decades before 2007, 2008. And what's remarkable is that they're missing a fact which was known, very well known since the early 1970s in the economics literature, which is that, now these models of neoclassical markets and equilibrium are very limited. They're probably not the whole picture in any case, but even on the terms of these models, the fact is that they have many equilibria. They don't just have one equilibria. They have many equilibria. This has been known since theorems proved in the early 1970s by distinguished economists. If there are many equilibria, then which one you're in, and in each one of which the market forces balance, then what determines which one you're in? Well, history, law, regulation, ethics, chance, innovation. How would you, in, say, 1960, have predicted the luggage market, the equilibrium of the luggage market? Because Einstein was brilliant. I take this remark from Eric Weinstein, who is a mathematician and economist who does brilliant work in this area. Einstein was brilliant and lugged his luggage around. Marx was brilliant and lugged his luggage around. Anybody you can mention was brilliant. Russell was brilliant and lugged his luggage around. And one person, whose name I forget, thought, why not put wheels on it? And changed all of our lives, as well as changed completely the market for luggage in a way that no economist could have predicted. There are many, many stories like that. So it's what I found remarkable confronting the economics and finance is how this notion that there has to be something timeless, there has to be this single timeless equilibrium the markets seek, blinded people to obvious critiques, and also has led to a situation where obvious solutions, that is studying the path dependence, the time dependence, the innovation dependence nature of markets, has been studied but not appreciated. And I'm talking about work by Brian Arthur, Pia Mullany, Eric Weinstein, Stu Kaufman, Per Bach. Many people from a broad range of backgrounds have done interesting work about how economics can be made more time-dependent, more dynamical, out of equilibrium, et cetera. And it seems that, and I don't know if there are any professional economists who want to address this, that there seems to be just a blinder about this whole issue. And I included it in the book because it comes down to whether you think that the truest version of anything is the timeless version. If you think that, you would be prone to be attracted to this single equilibrium misreading of the neoclassical theory. If you think, however, that the natural state of the world is to be always evolving in time, to be always out of equilibrium, to be always in a history-dependent way responding to surprises, to novelty, then you would be attracted to a path-dependent and time-dependent version of economics. So, which doesn't mean that we should all run off and make big computer simulations based on these alternative theories of economics and leave the ethical decisions about our economic systems to scientists running big computer programs. But it does mean that if we're going to trust at all the output of people running big computer programs, they should be motivated by reasonable ideas. Okay. Now, let me just very briefly respond to Anthony's points. Consciousness. What I meant to suggest, so I took real risks in this epilogue, and I did touch on the problem of the body-mind problem. And what I meant to suggest is not that there is something outside of naturalism at all, or not that there is a mental domain, but that we do not have the conceptual basis, we do not have the concepts or the framework scientifically to address the body-mind problem as a scientific problem. But for sure, qualia are part of nature, and here I've been reading recently Tom Nagel and Galen Strawson, if people know them, philosophers of mind, who make the point that qualia and mental events, mental experiences are part of the natural world and therefore must be accounted for in any acceptable version of naturalism. And I would just make the small point that if that's your project, it's not my project. In the book I say they're interesting problems, but they're too hard for me. It's not my project. But if that is your project, you're going to have a hell of a lot better time trying to assimilate qualia and mental events into a naturalism in which time is real and the present moment is real than one in which time is an illusion and the true nature of the world is timeless. But that's what I was meaning to suggest there. About 1 plus 1 equals 2, yes, so my reading on this is that truths like mathematical truths, like truths about games, facts about games of chess, are things that exist once they're invented by human beings. These are part of human culture. They're part of what human beings do. But that once invented, a system of mathematical objects, once invented and characterized, have properties that are objectively true and can be checked and proved independent of who does it and when they do it. So their time is 1 plus 1 equals 2. Once those concepts are on the table, will always be true from then on. But I don't think we need to believe in Plato's world of a different world of mathematical objects, and somehow one and one and two and equals and plus already existed for eternity somewhere outside of human culture and human experience. And I would use a notion of evoking. We evoke into existence things that didn't exist before, about which things become true when they're evoked. And this seems very strange to say in a naturalist one world, because a naturalist one world is nothing which could ever be new because it's all just reduced to motions of atoms. But if you live in a naturalist two world where nature has the possibility of generating novel phenomena which could be governed by novel laws, you're not surprised that human beings can partake in a small measure of the ability to evoke into existence novel sets of truths.
Professor Smolder, thanks very much. And I want to open this up, but I wonder if I can throw two questions at you, because first of all, it seems to me we could just dwell a little bit more on the science of it. And part of the title of your book, of course, is about the crisis in science at the moment, and the debate which you began in your earlier books has come out of what some of you may know as the string wars, the wars about the, well, the debates about the high hopes once had for string theory, and why those have not been satisfied. But I wonder if you can just spend a bit more time, explain to us what you think your account explains that that theoretical physics as has been practiced for much of this the past century does not. I mean, as you described it eloquently in your book, you think that this enterprise of setting out to devise a parallel world, if you like, of mathematically expressing the world in laws, that this is really a sort of mythical quest because these laws are evolving. And yes, that quest, as you've described it, has run into dead ends. But I wonder if you just explain to us what you think that this account, how it could lead to explanations that the practice of much of the past century doesn't.
I draw the line between questions having to do with small systems in the universe, laboratory systems, with the methods of and I know it's asking a certain sophistication to think about science in terms of methods, but I think one point is necessary here. Physics has been so successful because it has a particular method developed by Newton, and this method is exquisitely well suited to studying small parts of the universe and how they behave as seen from the outside. And this method has triumphed again and again and again through to the late 1970s, when it gave us the standard model of particle physics that has been so eloquently confirmed since then, and most recently in the discovery of the Higgs at the LHC, the Large Hadron Collider. Then we ran into a kind of wall in which all of our efforts to further unify broke down, and I think that there are two questions on which we've struggled and failed. One of them is not what are the laws of nature, but why are these the laws? One way or the other, in so many ways, we've tried to address that question. Why are these the laws of nature? Why are these the elementary particles? Why are these four forces and not others? Why the neutrino? Why the electron? Why the muon, etc.? And the point that I would like to argue is that this is a different kind of question than what are the laws of nature and can we discover through experimenting over and over again laws of nature that act in the laboratory and that act on any domain smaller than the universe as a whole. Why the laws are chosen, how the laws are chosen, is a cosmological question and needs to be addressed with a different method. And here, I think the right point of view, I very painfully came to it in the work leading to the idea of evolving laws, and that was what my first book was about, Cosmological Natural Selection, which is a hypothesis about evolving laws. But the idea that I came to, and this is humbling when this happens, and you discover that a philosopher was a century ahead of you, but Charles Sanders Peirce in 1893 considered the question of why these laws, why not other laws, and he said, law is paramount, the thing that needs an explanation. I'm not going to quote exactly word for word, but nothing is so in need of explanation as a regularity, a generality, or a law. And he says, the only possible way of accounting for laws of nature is if they are the result of evolution. If we used to think that a scientific discovery is a discovery of something which is outside of time, what Peirce realized and what I very painfully realized a century after him, if I'd been better educated, would have saved me years of time, was that once you believe that the laws of nature are timeless, you put them outside the domain that science can explain. Because science can only explain why things are the way they are if there's a causal progression, if there's a history that caused them to come the way they are. Why is that? Because if science explanation requires verification and requires hypotheses that are vulnerable to falsification, and that means there must be some experimental signal you can tease out, and that means that there must be something that happened to cause something to happen. Of course, I'm aware that each of my sentences has a chapter behind it to fully justify, but I think that Charles Sanders Peirce was right about that. So we make our theories more scientific, have a wider scope of explanation by only imagining laws to be governed in time and to be evolving in time. So you said, what questions do I think can be answered by this new framework? One of them is the why these laws question.
I wonder if the two of you might comment on two of the ideas it seems to be Professor Smolin is dealing with here. One is questions of determinism and whether the old models, if you like, relied on a kind of, or implied a kind of determinism. And the other one is which you touched on at length in your book and briefly here, is whether people should regard themselves as free agents, depending on which of these philosophies you espouse.
Just to pick up on the first point first, I could hear a critic of Lee's, so I'm just playing the devil's advocate here, say the following two things. Firstly, the picture that Lee offers us is one in which the laws of nature evolve, There might be a picture in which, for example, there's no big bang but a big bounce, and that when the big bounce happens, there's just very, very slight variation on analogy with what happens in biological evolution, so that there might be an adjustment to the configuration of laws in the universe that ensues from it, and it's in this way that the laws evolve. And looking at that kind of explanation is motivated by applying a principle, another philosophical principle that Lee adopts, Leibniz's principle of sufficient reason. This is in response to Peirce's point about there has to be an answer to the question, why these laws, why not other laws? So the critic might say, Lee, why don't you adopt the same strategy here as you did in your argument against the anthropic principle, where you said, let's just start from the fact that there are galaxies. You don't have to have as your premise the fact that you need galaxies for there to be life. You just start from the fact that there are galaxies. It's an observation.
You mean we wouldn't be having this discussion were these things not?
Exactly. So you just start from the observation that there are galaxies, and then you come to the conclusion that the Planck's constant has to be below a certain critical value. Why can't you just say there just are these laws? That's what the critic would say. I'm not urging this position against you. That would be one thing. And the other thing is that the critic might also say, are we safe to export the process, which is now very well observed and attested in the biological sphere, to the cosmological sphere? Can we, does the analogy hold absolutely, or might there be a few little leaks in it?
And Julian, what do you think about the jump that Professor Smullen has made from the hard sciences or not so hard sciences, arguing, as you put it, to the world of economics and anthropology and so on? I mean, did people ever really behave as if there were fixed laws of human behaviour in the same sense that one would talk about physics?
Well, maybe we should start talking about the slightly squidgy sciences instead of the hard sciences to indicate this slight sense of relativism. As Professor Smullen points out in his book, if you believe in neoclassical economics and the idea of equilibrium, you tend to conceive of humans as being these value-maximizing, entirely rational agents who are determined by economic desires and an ability to calculate rationally the value of everything. And as all of us sitting in this room know, in our everyday lives, that's kind of rubbish, because most of us have got no idea how to work out the value of our weekly shopping bill. We're not rational value-maximizing agents in that kind of calculation. Some of the time, we're very rational and driven by economic impulses. Some of the time, we're not, particularly me when I'm looking at shoes. And in some social contexts, in some societies, you can say that the principle of economics and competition and free markets works very well. Sometimes it doesn't. One of the ideas that I find very attractive in terms of borrowing ideas from Professor Smullen's work and looking at economies is this point that, the laws of physics can work very well in certain contexts for a period of time. They just don't explain everything all the time. And it's the same principle in markets. One can develop some very clever systems and calculations for predicting how a market might move that might seem to work very well for a few years until there's suddenly a break or disruption in the underlying tectonic plates or in the way that people think and react to each other. Some of the time people are, if you like, creatures of their environment and relatively predictable. Occasionally they're not. The problem is we just don't know when. And in some ways this also ties, oddly enough, into a sort of separate school of anthropology that I used to look at a lot when I was an anthropologist, which is really the works of Pierre Bourdieu, the French intellectual and anthropologist, who looked a lot at this question of the degree to which we are creatures of our environment and tried to understand how the individual relates to the wider social group and the degree to which individuals do not have free will, to not merely act outside the strictures of a social group, but also think outside the strictures of a social group, because the way we think is always shaped by the kind of cultural baggage we inherit and the kind of cognitive map we are brought up with and inherit, which again touches on this issue of determinism. And Bourdieu, as many of you will know, came to the conclusion that we're sort of creatures of our environment a lot of the time, and yet sometimes some of us can imagine a different type of cognitive map and can make a break, and that's essentially how societies and cultures change over time, again borrowing from this idea of evolution, which in many ways parallels some of what Professor Smolin's saying about how physics does have the potential for there being incremental change and for being variation, even if there are sometimes rules which leave the universe or ourselves trapped in a seemingly determinist way for periods.
So Anthony, first, so why not stop just stating what the laws are, knowing what the laws are? Because I think we can do better. I'm not a professional philosopher, but I find Leibniz's principle of sufficient reason an inspiration and a reason to hope we can do better. Can we do better, in fact? Who knows? Let's see. And whether the analogy to biology is just one way of realizing the idea that laws evolve. Evolve here means change. It doesn't necessarily mean evolve in a formal analogy to natural selection, although that's one example of it. Responding to Jillian, when you say that people are not running algorithms, people are not maximizing their, I forget, there's a technical term for it in the philosophical literature.
Utility.
Yeah.
Or value-maximizing behavior.
Your value-maximizing behavior. There's a hidden influence on my writing, and let me just come clean on it, and that's Jaron Lanier in his books You Are Not a Gadget and Who Owns the Future. And Jaron is developing exactly the kind of humanistic, non-algorithmic version of what technology is and what human beings are in relation to technology that I think is needed. And maybe one isn't supposed to say things like this. I'm waiting for the perceptive reviewer who reviews Jaron's books with my books and understands that we've been in continual conversation for more than a decade and that there are many commonalities in our projects.
Well, there's a cue. Let's go now to questions.
Good evening. Peter Cook. I wasn't clever enough to be a physicist. I'm a chemist, but I think that'll have to do. I'm also a musician, so I've crossed the boundary between science and the arts. My question comes about that whole division between the hard sciences and perhaps the soft ones. I'm wondering what physicists should learn from anthropologists and philosophers. I'm also wondering what the reverse of that question should be in terms of education for the future between those strange divisions between the arts and the sciences.
If I knew what I had to learn, I wouldn't need to have the conversation. Here's what I believe about... I believe that there is great value to specialization. You have to master something before you have something to communicate to people with other specializations. To quote Jaron again, who I love to quote, before you can share, you have to be someone. Of course, he's thinking about the internet, but I think it applies to interdisciplinary conversations. But once you have a methodology, once you are trained in a discipline, there is a lot to share, and I think there's a lot to share because in the different sciences, in the different arts, what we are doing is trying to invent the future or explore the future. And I think our society has a kind of incoherence because I, as a physicist, barely know what's going on in the frontiers of biology, let alone what's going on in the frontiers of anthropology, let alone what questions artists ask each other when they get together and talk about the future of their disciplines, whether it's painting or performance art or whatever. And I think it's a very important project and one I try to engage in, to have conversations between people on different frontiers of exploring the future. But because I expect to learn enormously and have learned enormously from those conversations, I wouldn't try to characterize what I have to learn. I think it's an important... I think to be having such an incoherent culture makes it difficult to face the problems we face in the future. We would be better off if we had a more coherent conversation across the different boundaries of the different disciplines. But having said that, there are conversations between people deeply immersed in a discipline and a training.
Gillian, do you want to come in briefly on that?
Briefly. I'm actually writing a book about silo busting myself right now, so I would echo entirely what Professor Smolin says. You do need specialization. You can't just have everyone in an interdisciplinary mush, but you need to have cultural translators. You need to have people who can actually try and translate across the silos. You need to have common respect for each other's languages. And you also need to look at institutional impediments, because at the moment, the structure of universities absolutely does not encourage people to hop between different academic disciplines. And the institutional incentives matter enormously, because one of the reasons why finance and economics were so physics-driven and so mathematically driven for such a long time was because it suited the bankers very well. So too in terms of how structures, the academic structures operate.
Jim Craig Gray, I started off as a physicist but ended up as a biologist. The laws of physics, if they are subject to change, is that itself subject to a meta-law of physics? And are those meta-laws perhaps also mutable, so you get an infinite regress of laws and laws and laws?
That is one horn of the dilemma that we call the meta-law dilemma. The other arm, the other horn of the dilemma would be there are no meta-laws. Things just change. Things just happen. And there's, in either case, one case an infinite regress, in the other case a limit to our understanding, to our explanations. I think that this is the sort of dilemma that is productive, because it's possible to invent options which are hypotheses about meta-laws or meta-dynamics of laws which avoid the infinite regress and avoid the why this meta-law problem. And I discuss four different approaches to that in the book. And let me leave it there, because it would take 5 minutes to characterize just one of them. But that is, let me go out on a limb and say that a century from now, if I understand anything about the way that physics and cosmology have to evolve, people will see the meta-law dilemma and its transcendence or solution as key events in the history of cosmology.
Hi, I'm Doug Morrison, and I'm a physicist. I'm trying to give it up. My question, though, is about mathematics. Don't you think that's probably life and intelligent life on many other planets in the universe, and that they will have things like prime numbers, and the prime numbers they have will be identical to the prime numbers we have?
Most
and
likely.
That makes it more sensible to consider it a timeless thing rather than just depending on when somebody thought of the concept of prime numbers. That doesn't affect what the prime numbers are.
Of course. I think it's quite likely that there are a lot of parallel inventions if there are other intelligent life and other civilizations, but that doesn't require me. In fact, I don't see why it helps to imagine that prime numbers existed 1 second after the Big Bang. I think it's completely clear for me to imagine that they have to be invented, but once invented, their properties will agree. So that is, just because something is an artifact of human culture doesn't mean it's arbitrary. There are many things which are inventions and artifacts of human culture which are far from arbitrary. For example, that wheeled luggage is better. Wheeled luggage will never be uninvented, and I'm sure that it will be invented in every civilization across the galaxy, except maybe some unfortunate one which lacked the imagination to invent it.
Stephen Bartlett, I'm afraid I'm tonight's second chemist. I just wondered if Professor Smolin could perhaps explain a little bit a thought that lies behind something which he said more than once this evening, and I apologize if I've misquoted it, but as a naturalist type too, I think I heard you say that nature has the possibility to bring forth novel events, or words to these, to that nature. The thing that I feel slightly uncomfortable about with that is that I'm perceiving that as nature as an autonomous agent, as you might say. Was that your intention, or is that merely the fact that I'm not a philosopher that makes me think that?
No, that's the inadequacy of my language. But what I have in mind in your domain is the possibility of nature making new entangled states of complicated or large molecules, but still coherent entangled quantum states. And as you know, an entangled quantum state has properties that are not properties of any of the subsystems involved. So if there is a new protein which the biosphere develops, and as you know, almost none of the possible proteins, the number of proteins which have been evoked into existence is very tiny compared to the number of possible chains of amino acids of a few hundred sequences long. And if one imagines a chain of amino acids being made as a result of some mutation of some in biology, which has never existed in the history of the universe before, which certainly must have happened many times, and imagine an entangled state of that molecule, that's something which is genuinely novel properties which have never existed in the history of the universe. Now, so that's the kind of thing that I have in mind. What I have in mind, which is and up till now is totally conventional, what I have in mind is unconventional and is described in one of the chapters of the book, is the hypothesis that maybe the quantum mechanics would not know how that novel entangled state should evolve until there had been many versions of it.
Anita Punwani Fellow, I only got A-level maths and physics, so I may not understand your responses. Gillian, you mentioned about environments and how it affects behavior. Does an increasingly complex and uncertain and fast-paced environment explain why financial markets are more short-termist, if indeed they are?
Andy Haldane from the Bank of England has done some great work on this. Certainly a culture that's increasingly driven by instant gratification, and where there's increased transparent competition between asset managers and investors, and a sense of immediate consequences and paybacks is one where markets are a lot more unstable because of a lot of the short-term impulses at work today. And, you know, the point really, looking back to Professor Smolin's work, is that as the environment, the wider environment changes, be that in relation to the impact of social media or transparency or regulation, et cetera, some of the core dynamics and laws of markets and environment and economics can change too.
I want to ask Lee a question that you kind of asked, which is, what would an evolving law look like? Does it mean, are you meaning a sort of a change in a value, like the speed of light, for example, or E equals MC to the power of 1.95 or something? Or do you mean something more fundamental than that? What does it mean to imagine an evolving law?
I have in mind any hypothesis which has experimental implications. So some of the things you mentioned I have considered, like parameters changing in time, either abruptly or slowly, and I've also considered some modifications to the laws themselves. And I think it's the job of the philosophical or the general programmatic argument leads to Peirce's conclusion that if laws are to be explained, they must have evolved. But it's up to scientists to make specific hypotheses about how they evolve, which are testable. And I'm happy to entertain anyone as long as it's testable, as long as it has a further implication or ramification which can be tested in a real experiment.
My name's Heather Miller. I studied English trading as an accountant, and I work as a civil servant. So I feel I've been crossing some of these silos. And I'd just like to emphasize that question at the front. I mean, we all agree that our understanding of laws of nature change over time, the way we perceive them changes, but I don't know of an example of a law of nature that has changed. So it seems to me we're asserting that there's an evolution of these laws without any evidence to support that, but a lot of evidence to support laws of nature being immutable. So I just wondered if Professor Smolin's got any examples of a law of nature that has changed.
Very briefly, I have hypotheses about it, and one of them is the hypothesis of cosmological natural selection. And this hypothesis, when developed in detail, made several predictions which are checkable
And they have so far held up. And again, I don't want to take the time. If you want to ask me later, I could take the time to explain in detail. But if correct, if verified, these changes would be taking place at the Big Bang, that is, during what Antony characterizes as the Big Bounce, the Big Bang being a transition from some previous state of the universe to a present state of the universe. And so I'm not proposing in that hypothesis that the laws change before our eyes. They change abruptly at certain very violent events like Big Bangs. But the other idea, the idea that I was discussing with the gentleman as the chemist, would be one that if that version is true, then we could actually make laws change in the laboratory. But that has not been verified yet.
One area that's at the nexus of the silos of arts and sciences is design. And I loved your example of the suitcase, because it's design thinking often can deal with complex situations in different ways. And some people feel that design thinking could move beyond the shoes and think of and change the world in bigger ways. Have you any comments on the luggage example? Was it just a humorous example, or is there a serious point there?
There is a serious point, which is that genuinely, we can be genuinely surprised by innovations that afterwards anybody... I mean, did you ever discuss that with somebody in the luggage business and they say, my God, why didn't I think of that? And that happens so often if you're a scientist, I'm sure if you're an artist of any kind, where you see some novel idea and you think, my God, I should have thought of that years ago. So I mean really that. But I'm very impressed. The part of the design world that I see up close, it has to do with urban and planning and urban design, and I think that our opportunities to design the cities where people will thrive in the next century is vastly underappreciated.
If you look at where the most exciting interdisciplinary work is coming out of America today, it's often linked in some way to architecture. I mean, the MIT Media Lab, where I've spent a bit of time, is a good example of that. And my personal theory is that architects are forced to address directly and think about the way we classify space around us. They're forced to turn our abstract cognitive maps into a tangible spatial map. And when you do that, you tend to start thinking, gosh, isn't it strange how we map the world? What would happen if we not just thought outside the boxes, but between the boxes and tried to rearrange the boxes? And that's one of the reasons why a lot of creative thinking comes out of visualization.
Anthony?
There's an interesting analogy to be drawn between design, which is a wonderfully admirable thing when it works, and the inventiveness and creativity on display at the Design Museum, for example, illustrates that fact. There's a wonderful analogy between that and articulating ideas, finding a vocabulary, a language in which you can express something, new ways of expressing things. A particular example would be the developments in mathematics that enabled new physical concepts to be expressed at the beginning of the Standard Model in physics, for example, made it possible, empowered thinking in a new and much more creative way. So there is it's almost as if finding a vocabulary, finding a means of articulating ideas were like finding a new architecture or design for thought, so that you grasp things and get insights into things much more richly and deeply. And there is a kind of parallel between the suitcase with wheels case and the Riemannian geometry case, if you like.
I'm David Sington. I make films, and I've made a couple of films about physics, and I've made a film about economics. But it doesn't mean to say I understand anything about any of those things. I love the book. It was very clear, and I understood it, I think. It seems to me that the history of the progress of science is a sort of dance between theoretical ideas and observations, and sometimes the invention of instruments that allow people to make new observations, and these sort of prompt new theoretical ideas. And I wondered, do you have some thoughts about what kind of new observations we could make, or new sorts of instruments that we might develop that would allow perhaps these ideas to progress, rather than simply being confined to, it seems to be, string theory, to people, you know, with blackboards?
Well, I discuss several in the book, as you know. I would be wait to be surprised. I mean, I think that quantum computing may be a laboratory which has lots of surprises in it. As we develop the possibility of manipulating large, complex, but coherent, quantum mechanically coherent systems, I mean, it would be wonderful to make a quantum computer, but it would be even more wonderful if they behave in surprising ways. So I think that that's a technology that I find very interesting. I think the we're not done yet opening windows on the early universe. The window of gravitational radiation is going to have much to teach us about the very early stages of the universe, and maybe even going before the Big Bang.
Julian, do you have thoughts on that, or generally on the conversation as we're getting to the last moments of it?
My main thought is, isn't it fabulous that this debate about physics is taking place in a building entitled Royal Society of Arts? There needs to be a lot more of this kind of dialogue occurring at the moment, and with a mutual respect for language and a mutual respect and desire to try and understand what the other disciplines are saying. I often think, when I look back to my own education, that I left maths and physics far too early. I wish I'd done more of it. I'm trying to catch up, often rather badly, but I deeply appreciate Professor Smolin's attempt to reach out, effort to reach out into other areas as he develops what he's saying in terms of physics. So, thank you.
Anthony.
Perhaps people don't appreciate as much as Lee might wish them to, how revolutionary it would be if these ideas really took off and people found that there was considerable substance to them. And I was just reflecting there for a moment on the consequences for thinking about symmetrical systems. I'm hesitant to introduce this because it might invite Lee to have to give too long an answer to it, but the idea that entanglement, quantum entanglement, results in what sometimes looks like transfer of information in a physical system at speeds greater than the speed of light, superluminal transference of information. Lee, in the Rosen-Podolsky-Einstein effect, for example, which has been observed experimentally, when you split a particle into two and you change the properties of one and you find instantaneously the properties of the other mirroring it, this seems to suggest, or has suggested to physicists, time symmetry, that the universe is the same backwards and forwards, or even indeed in the case of somebody like David Bohm, something like an implicate order, that everything is already, you know, sort of frozen into the facts about the universe, and so this is something which was just the outcome of the natural play of physical forces. All those ways of thinking about things would be very seriously disrupted if Lee is right, and of course that would be tremendously exciting.
Professor Smollett, I want to just come to an end. I know as I'm walking down the street, I will have more than one question in mind, but I wondered if I could ask you at least one of those, which will be front of my mind. And that is, supposing one accepted all the scientific arguments you've made, still, if you push at this question of why this should apply to us here, why this should change our notion of what it is to act as a person. You said you said the laws of physics as they are apply to small parts of the universe, and we are definitely that, and our sense of time as real is most definitely embedded in the way we talk and all our notions. Why should all this, even if we accepted all of your arguments about theoretical physics, why should that actually change what we think it is to be an active person?
Let me put your question slightly differently. Supposing that this succeeds, and I'm very humbled, but I have to agree with what Anthony said, that if this succeeds, it will be a major change in the direction of science. But supposing it does succeed, how might that affect how people think of themselves as individuals? I think the idea that we're machines, the idea that we're completely, perfectly emulatable by a computer running a program, whether a classical computer or a quantum computer, is very deep in our culture. And it comes from a belief that we're part of a physical world, which I believe in, but that further that physical world is running a computation. So if the physical world is running a computation, then each of us is running a computation, and therefore we're emulatable by a computer. And again, and one reason why I mentioned Jaron Lanier is his critique of how much of the technology that we use every day and every hour has been designed, speaking of design, with the metaphor that we're designing machines to be used by machines. How much of how Microsoft Word is constructed is constructed on the basis of a vision of what human beings are, which is machine-like. And if we lose the cosmological basis for thinking that the universe is emulatable by a computer, if the emulatable is a program, then we lose the basis or the authority behind the metaphor that human beings are machines. And I think that human beings are purely natural. I'm not evoking anything supernatural, but I don't think we're anything like machines. I don't think we're anything like programmable digital computers. And I think that our conception of ourselves and our relationship to technology that we develop will change in a more humanistic direction under this change. So that's just one way.
This could clearly be continued, not just by me and our panel, but by all of you. Thank you for being a fantastic audience. Thanks to the RSA, to Alan Lane, the publishers. Thanks to my excellent panel, and thank you to Professor Smolin.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.